Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the news today of the death of George McGovern and speak with Richard Parker, who was a political advisor to the former Democratic presidential nominee who in 1972 lost to Richard Nixon. We will discuss McGovern's life and legacy and whether a candidate of the left like McGovern could be elected in today's right-wing political and media environment. Then we'll look at the polls that are all over the place and talk with someone who has accurately predicted the winner of all of the past presidential elections since 1984. The distinguished professor of history at American University, Alan Lichtman, joins us to discuss why, in spite of Romney's surge in the polls, he feels Obama will still be re-elected to a second term. Then finally, following the deaths of American diplomats in Libya, a tragic incident that has been blown up into a presidential election issue, we will speak with Abubakar Saad, a former Libyan diplomat from Benghazi. We will discuss the chaos that has become a political football in a country that is essentially lawless, with groups of militias and tribes vying over regional control with little to no national army or police. Joining us now is Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He is the former managing editor of Ramparts and was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. He was a political advisor to George McGovern, who passed away today. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Good to be with you, Ian, as always.
And I take it that this is a sad day for you. You lost not only somebody that you worked for, but somebody that was a friend.
Yeah, and, you know, it was more than that. Even it was that a way of life or a kind of American is passing out of American politics. McGovern was a Midwestern Democrat who had grown up as a Republican at a time when there was a branch of progressive Republicans that were more politically to the left than the dominant sector in the Democratic Party today. They were deeply alarmed by the rise of large corporations. They were struggling to hold on to what they thought of as the values which people like them had fought for in the Civil War. They'd been very influenced by Teddy Roosevelt and also had become respectful of Woodrow Wilson. And in George McGovern's case, were already moving toward Franklin Roosevelt by the Great Depression because they saw Roosevelt, oddly enough, representing the ethical values of what they thought their Republican Party had represented when Lincoln was its head. So that's a kind of landscape of American politics that I think is probably unknown to most of your younger listeners, but is an important part of American history that dominated American history from the 1850s up through the 1970s, and it's going away.
So why did this decorated World War II bomber pilot lose so badly during the very unpopular Vietnam War against Richard Nixon, who cynically suggested he was going to end the war, but in fact prosecuted it for a number of years and, of course, eventually left the White House in disgrace over Watergate. I have never understood why it is the American public rejected a man on the basis that he was attacked for being soft on American national security, soft on communism, right, which, of course, was the great canard during the Cold War, right, and yet had all the authenticity of a true American hero.
Well, I think, you know, you ask a terrific question, and I think it goes to this sense in which McGovern was part of a heritage that was exploding and dying, if you will, all around us in 1968 and 1972. I think that the reason that he lost so badly, and it was like, I don't know, I think he had 38% compared to Nixon's 60% of the vote in 1972, which was, you know, Nixon would rank up there with Franklin Roosevelt and others as, you know, a landslide victory. I mean, poor George McGovern carried just Massachusetts, where I'm sitting today, plus the District of Columbia, Nixon won 49 other states. I think the reason was that the coalition that Franklin Roosevelt had built of ethnic and often Catholic blue-collar workers north of the Mason-Dixon line, plus white Southerners, because black Southerners were still barely beginning to vote, having been denied the vote after the Civil War. That coalition was falling apart by the late 1960s. And as it fell apart, many of its members turned angrily against the Democratic Party. So in a sense, it was a protest vote against the change in the Democratic National Presidential Party as much as it was a vote for Richard Nixon. You know, we hear today about how Richard Nixon had a Southern strategy, but I think in some sense he was like a surfer riding a wave rather than a surfer who created or bent the wave that he rode. It wasn't so much that the Southern strategy precipitated change. It was a strategy that was reacting to change that was manifestly taking place. What was going on? Since the mid-1950s, race had been brought back to the center of national American politics, and the regional clash that had gone from the 1820s up to 1860 and then precipitated secession and the Civil War had been reignited in the 1950s. We can talk about why in a minute. The second was that the war in Vietnam had started in some sense inadvertently as far as the American people were concerned. No one had had much explained to them why we were in Vietnam. And the one template that they had, or two templates that they had to deal with, which framed resolve about the war, was one, America's crushing victory in the Second World War over fascism, and two, the structure of the anti-communist, anti-Moscow, anti-Beijing global political frame that had been adopted after the Second World War. So we had been taught by by Franklin Roosevelt himself the principle of unconditional surrender in the case of the Second World War. No compromise with the enemy, no negotiated settlements. And then second, we had been taught by the experience of anti-communism over a 50-year, 60-year, 70-year period, plus the specifics of Korea, where a compromise solution had been imposed, that somehow to, as the supporters of the war used to say in the 1960s, to cut and run in Vietnam was not just a disgrace, but a strategic error of the most egregious kind that would lead only to more war. So those were two factors, race and Vietnam. And then the third was everything associated with the youth movements and the counterculture and the student rebellions and the life, whatever we want to call them, the lifestyle changes, feminism, gay rights, environmentalism. This was one after another of bowling pins of American culture being knocked over by the claims of American youth, by and large, saying the rights that make you a citizen of the United States have not been equally extended to all, and they are now going to be. And for lots and lots of people, that kind of change was very frightening. And so George McGovern was an adult among the youth who was actually willing to side with the direction in which they were going. In fact, willing to stand up and lead in the direction in which they were going because of his vision of the country coming out of having been perversely raised a prairie Republican back at the time of the First World War.
Well, Richard Parker, professor of economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center, and he worked as a political advisor to George McGovern. When McGovern was defeated, concurrently, the sort of infamous meeting took place between the later to be Justice of the Supreme Court and his neighbor, the head of the American Chamber of Commerce, where the Lewis Powell memo was formed in response to the student rebellions against the Vietnam War. And in many ways, that became a blueprint for the right-wing takeover of our politics, particularly the corporate takeover of our politics. So in many ways, it seems to me that the reaction against the Vietnam War was much more powerful and enduring than the great movement that had taken place that, in fact, McGovern wasn't able to ride in on. And you had this vast anti-war movement at the minute that Nixon finally ended that war or wound it down. They went away. They weren't a continuing political factor. So I just get this strong impression that nobody like McGovern would ever be elected in this political environment anymore because the country's moved so far to the right. And indeed, many people have said that Ronald Reagan wouldn't even get the nomination on the Republican in the Republican
Party. That's very possible. I mean, again, you're speaking to the changing geography and demographics of the United States, and the way I try to portray it to my students is you have to think about region, you have to think about race, and you have to think about religion. That the period George McGovern grew up in was what we call the wave two migration of Europeans and Irish coming to what had been before that basically a British Isles and African culture. That is, the first wave of settlement, the colonial period in the 17th and 18th century, meant that the overwhelming majority of the white population in the 13 colonies and for the first 40 years thereafter originated as English speakers from England, Scotland, and Wales, and to a lesser extent among Scots-Irish in Scotland and Ireland. The second wave of migration starts when the Irish and then the Germans, followed by the Poles and the Russians and the Italians and a whole surge coming out of continental Europe, began entering the United States in the 1830s. And that second wave population coincides with industrialization and urbanization and utterly transforms the original founders'. I don't know if you want to call it dream, I don't know if you want to call it flawed vision, but was which had been of an agrarian rural democracy with a centralized state of limited power because there were no corporations in America in 1800. By 1900, the dominant economic factor in America was not the small farmer, the small shopkeeper, the small businessman, it was the giant corporation. You have to remember that when George McGovern wrote his doctoral thesis in history at Northwestern, he wrote it on the Rockefeller mines in Colorado and the famous coal strikes that had occurred there, which had for a time been one of the, young people don't know about it today, but for 50 years from 1910 until 1960, those were legendary strikes in the history of American labor and American labor organizing against the concentrated power of interests like the Rockefellers and the Morgans. And so, you know, McGovern had done all of his doctoral research on that coal strike, and so he was intimately acquainted with that progressive labor-based history and deeply identified with it. The second was that his thesis advisor had been Arthur Link, who was probably for many, many years the most famous biographer of Woodrow Wilson. And so McGovern also had a Wilsonian, Franklin Rooseveltian internationalism to him that meant that he took on the idea of America being a global power that many Midwestern Democrats and Republicans had resisted right up to the Second World War. And in fact, many Republicans early on after the Second World War were still resisting. So McGovern represented that whole wave one of migration, the Protestants, the Scots, the Methodists, the plain small farmers. His father, in fact, had been a Methodist minister who never earned more than $100 a month. And so George McGovern knew life as a small town boy in rural South Dakota, raised with a strong sense of values, who was taught by his Methodist parents that this idea of being the promised land and of having a moral responsibility not only to make the chosen people work as a kind of justice, but that it was to work not in a pietistic after you're dead, but in a social gospel here on earth. And so he was driven always by the deepest of moral and familial values, which is what made him so striking in the time after Richard Nixon, where cynicism and manipulation once again took hold of American politics as it had in the late 19th century.
Well, but we're on the cusp, Richard Parker, of a possible election of a representative of the 1%, the final victory of the oligarchy over the democracy. I mean, in many ways, McGovern must have been, in the last months here, feeling totally defeated, that the corporate power that he identified against, remember the 47%? He right. represented the 47%.
My father was an Episcopal minister, and my mother was raised in South Dakota, and her best friend as a child back in the 1920s was the daughter of the last previous Democratic senator elected from South Dakota before McGovern. And so one of the many conversations I had with him was about those kinds of value systems that preachers' kids grow up with. McGovern was not defeated in any real sense in the last 6 months of his life. This is a fight that carries on all your life, and this is a fight that carries on after your life, and your job is to fight the best fight you can and to pass the willingness to fight down to a new generation. I don't think he was so much shocked by the asserted power of the 1%. What took him aback was the quietude of so many middle-class and working-class Americans. As I say, he came from a morally constructed vision of America that was then infused with a deep sense of the justice of labor struggles and, thought that the backbone of America were the small farmers, small business people, and workers of the country who could, because they had, in some sense, risen up at the beginning of the 20th century and clawed back, to some extent, real power. Now, had it been permanent? No, they seem to have lost it in the 1920s, but then the madness of the 1929 crash precipitated the Great Depression, out of which then came a whole new era of democratic big D and small d governance under Roosevelt. And it was, in that tradition that McGovern was then elected after the Second World War, and it was that tradition in which he served in the House and in the Senate in the 1950s and 60s.
Well, just in closing, Richard Parker, I remember interviewing George McGovern, and he told this amazing story of his World War II experiences as a bomber pilot, returning from a mission over Austria. He was based in Italy, and the plane had been shot up, and they were flying back, and the bombs were still stuck in the bomb bay, and they couldn't get the bomb out because they can't land with a bomb, and it's likely to go off. So they eventually were banging on this bomb to try and get it loose, and eventually they managed to get it loose, and McGovern watched it fall, and it fell right onto a farmhouse in northern Italy. And he, being growing up on a farm, knew that it was midday, and the whole family, the farmer's family, would be sitting around having their midday meal. So he was absolutely stricken by this memory of this of dropping this bomb on this farmhouse for many decades. And then apparently he told the story on Austrian television, and sure enough, the farmer got in touch with him, who was still alive, and all his family was still alive, and they said, don't feel guilty anymore. We escaped. We saw the plane in trouble, and we saw the bomb come down, and we got the hell out of there. So this is the man that somehow was not patriotic enough to become president of the United States. Go figure.
I think that was what was so deep. I worked in that campaign, and I also worked in his last political campaign in 1980 for the Senate. And I think that if there was just a hint of bitterness, it was the accusation that Nixon and the Republicans had leveled against him of lack of patriotism. For a guy who had been a bomber pilot and done, dozens of missions, including that one, and had won a Distinguished Flying Cross and a Bronze Star and everything else, the idea that Nixon, who had been a supply officer in the Navy and had never seen actual combat, could accuse him, McGovern, of being a coward not a patriot, stuck in his craw in a really deep way that other accusations didn't. I think that's actually quite right. And I think it's also really important to remember, because so much of the new left was willing to reject an idea of patriotism as part of its rejection of what it saw as American imperialism in Vietnam, that patriotism actually has a place in the left's iconography. And it may be that thinking about what George McGovern and his generation did, and also how George McGovern cared for the fate of that Italian farm family, should be the way we think of patriotism, particularly in times of war. I wish there was some evidence that we could feel that way as we're dropping those drone-carried bombs across Afghanistan and once across Iraq and so many parts of the rest of the world today.
Well, Richard Parker, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and he's also a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He is a former managing editor of Ramparts and was co-founder of Mother Jones magazine and served on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. He was a political advisor to George McGovern, who passed away today. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with somebody who believes that in spite of Romney's surge in the polls, Obama will win.
He summoned all of his strength in a climb. It suffered all of his strength in a fall. Sometimes when he got into fighting, man, he could fight with you all day long. Good man, and now he's gone. Welcome
back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, Distinguished Professor of History at American University, who has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predict the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you, Ian.
And clearly this race is tightening between President Obama and Mitt Romney. I know your prediction system has nothing to do with the polls, but nevertheless, the polls are obsessing the chattering class, and they're all over the place. Do you have any opinions on the poll?
I do. First of all, how do you verify a poll? Since not a single vote has been counted, there is no reality against which you can check the accuracy of a poll except by taking another poll. And how do you check the reality of that poll? You take another poll until you finally reach the ultimate poll, the election itself. That's why conventional political punditry and commentary is worthless. It has no scientific grounding whatsoever, and it's always adjusted to the last poll or the election itself, so it's always retrospective and never predictive. For example, in 1988, after George H.W. Bush came from behind in the polls and won, all the commentators said, that brilliant George Bush. He ran all of those nasty negative ads, like the Willie Horton ad, that brought down his opponent, Michael Dukakis. Well, if George H.W. Bush had lost, the same pundits would have been saying, that's stupid, George H.W. Bush. Didn't he know when you represent the party holding the White House, you can't run negative ads like that? You've got to be presidential. So you can really discount all of the commentary and all of the punditry based on the polls because it has no scientific validity, whatever. That said, it doesn't mean the polls have no predictive value at all. But as you point out, with the polls all over the place, ranging anywhere from, I think the Gallup had Obama behind by 6, Romney ahead by 6. Other polls had Obama ahead by 3. I've seen polls in Florida anywhere from Romney up by 2 to Obama up by 6. So I don't think you can say anything right now based on the polls. Plus, as we know, these polls can fluctuate depending upon events. And we have another debate coming up in a day.
Well, how much, though, do these debates affect things? Because it appears, if you're to believe the polls, and again, you know, you've made some serious caveats there about believing the polls. My hunch of what's happened here is that Obama had very successfully framed Romney through his negative advertising, and Romney, of course, had helped Obama with that. The tape of where he mentioned the 47% not taking responsibility for their lives, and the fact that that Romney did well in that first debate, and the fact that most people were paying attention for the first time, some 70 million Americans, enabled him to completely etch a sketch his entire campaign on the stump for the previous 2 years, and then appear to be a moderate overnight. And nobody, you know, it's a cynical move, but nobody's following it very closely. And that a lot of Americans who weren't really paying much attention suddenly thought, and the center that's supposed to decide suddenly thought, well, this guy maybe is not as bad, you know, and therefore they're starting to reconsider him, and some of them are actually considering him, and it's a double whammy, because in giving Romney more credibility, you're also, these people these swing voters are also saying, well, everything that Obama said about him so far is a lie. So isn't that what's happened here?
Well, in terms of the narrative of the campaign, I think that's mostly right. What I think you've missed is that Obama had an historical meltdown in the first debate. It wasn't just that Romney won the debate. It was that Obama lost the debate by a much larger margin than we've ever seen before in the history of debating. So this was, in effect, an unprecedented kind of debate. It wasn't just the normal debate effects that you might see where one candidate, you know, wins by 10, 15, 20 points like we saw in the second debate. And I do think that did change the narrative of the campaign because it was historically unprecedented. It did not change the fundamentals, which for a long time, based on the keys to the White House, have been pointing to an Obama win. But again, the keys, of course, are based on history. And whether an historical breakdown like that can or cannot change history, we won't know for a couple of weeks.
Again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, a distinguished professor of history at American University, who studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. So, most of the punditry, and I take it that there's some historical basis to this, indicates that if you have unemployment at the kind of level that we have, no president's been able to overcome
that. Incorrect.
Except for FDR.
That's false. First of all, there was much higher unemployment in 1936,
right,
when Franklin Roosevelt was reelected with 60% of the vote. Unemployment was well over 10%. Number two, while you can, you know, draw distinctions about tenths, unemployment was almost exactly the same when Ronald Reagan won 60% of the vote. Today it's, what, 7.8? During his reelection, it was about 7.5. And it could well go down to 7.5 when the final report is in. So, you know, all of these, this is the first time, this is the only time. Those have no scientific basis either. They're just plucking facts out of the air. That's like when George W. Bush was running in 1980, it was, no sitting vice president has been elected president since Martin Van Buren, you know, 150 years earlier. Meaningless stuff. Meaningless.
Well, but It seems that it has been a drag. It certainly is what Romney mostly campaigns on is jobs, sure. jobs, and more jobs, and I'm the sure. job creator.
It's not a good thing. Absolutely right.
And that the fact that that there's been a shift in it with the swing voters indicates to me that he has Romney has managed to come across as being electable, and prior to that, Obama, through his advertising, had made him unelectable and unsuitable. So,
well, I think that, again, that's all speculation. That's all being based on the polls,
right.
which, you know, do tilt, and we don't know why they tilt and change throughout the election. But no question, the economy is not a plus for Obama. If you were to predict this election solely based on the economy, you would not predict an Obama win. In fact, if you were to base this election solely on the economy and solely on the debate, you might predict a landslide for Mitt Romney. But the whole lesson of the keys is you can't reduce a presidential election just to that. There are a lot more factors that have to be taken into account. That's why I have 13 performance factors and not one or two. All of one or two models fail.
Well, President Bill Clinton, who is campaigning for Obama, just a couple of days ago said that this shouldn't be a race. The only reason it is because Americans are impatient on things not made before yesterday, and they don't understand why the economy is not totally hunky-dory again. What do you think of his analysis?
I think there's a lot of truth to what Bill Clinton says. Bill Clinton is a shrewd guy, and I do think that if, in fact, the economy was good, given everything else, this would not be a close race. This would be a runaway. But given the drag on the economy, even though I think on balance things favor Obama, obviously the economy is the weak point. But I again say those who claim the economy is the only thing, if they were right, this would be a landslide for Romney.
So you're obviously sticking with your earlier predictions, Alan Lichtman, that Obama will win this.
Correct.
And what's your sense then of how in the closing weeks it all seems to come down to the so-called swing voter, the undecided, the persuadable?
Another myth. How do we know who is undecided? The only way we know is people tell the pollsters. And we know that's not true. For example, the Gallup poll in 1984, around this time, had Jimmy Carter ahead by 7 points. Ronald Reagan won by 10, a 17-point swing. Does that mean, and yet, again, just like today, you would have assumed from the polls very few people are undecided. We have this myth in our heads that just because people tell the pollsters something, that it is necessarily valid. Absolutely untrue. People don't focus on exactly how they're going to vote till very close to the election, often in the polling place. So there are potentials for vastly greater swings than the conventional wisdom would have us believe.
But my understanding, Alan Lichtman, is that this is a fairly conservative country, and it's pretty unusual for a liberal to get elected, and we're just honoring the memory today of George McGovern, who, of course, got really trounced in 1972. And my sense is that in many ways, Obama got elected in 2008 because of Bush. And I think if you looked at that second debate, the very mention of Bush is it's like he's totally toxic, you know.
All this proves my point. Exactly right. Obama got elected because the voters, based on the keys, and I predicted that election in April 2003, were not going to give the Republicans 4 more years in office. That's the way the keys work. Votes are up or down on the performance of the party holding the White House. This time, however, given the overall performance, not just the economy, it's enough to predict and Obama win, a very different situation. And by the way, Obama is no George McGovern. George McGovern was way to the left of Barack Obama. Barack Obama is center left. George McGovern was hard left, just like Barry Goldwater 8 years before him in 64 was hard right. Plus, George McGovern is nothing like today's politicians. Today's politicians are consultant-driven, poll-driven, huckster-driven. They very rarely say anything of value or significance or controversy. George McGovern stood up for his principles. He wasn't watching the polls. He said what he believed and never trimmed his sails to what he thought might be popular. So I don't think it's a valid comparison.
Well, it wasn't so much a comparison. It's just that I think that the electorate tends to be conservative, and that I was suggesting that Obama got elected, in a sense, because the other guy had screwed up so much.
No question.
And
I agree with that.
I agree with you. He's a centrist. There's no question about it. He's never been a leftist. But he is being portrayed as such, and that if the other guy looks like he actually isn't as bad as they said he was and maybe is electable, then the natural conservative tendency of the American electorate is such that they'll swing to Romney. That's what I'm suggesting.
Well, again, that's pure speculation. There's no historical evidence to back that up. We've elected conservative presidents. We've elected liberal presidents. We've elected centrist presidents. I mean, I remember everyone saying Ronald Reagan can't be elected in 1980 because he's hard right and Jimmy Carter is right smack in the center and we're a centrist country and we'll never go for Ronald Reagan. Well, of course, Jimmy Carter's performance was so poor that there was no question that Ronald Reagan was going to win, and he won by 10 points.
And that was because of the only one and only debate. Everything, Carter was ahead until that one debate. And then
incorrect.
That's not true?
No.
Go ahead and tell me.
There have been studies of this based on the polls of polls. Going into the debate, Ronald Reagan was ahead 4 or 5 points on the average of the polls going into the debate. And did win by a larger margin than that, which may have been due to the debate or may have been to the fact that the polls were not accurate before. That's the problem. We don't know. How can you know whether it was the debate or simply that people coalesced and made up their minds and the polls weren't right before the debate? Since there is no reality check on a poll, any poll-based commentary can't be proven correct.
So I hesitate to ask you, Alan, about what do you think will happen on Monday night and whether it'll be significant in any way.
Well, I do think debates are significant. You know, if they're like historic meltdowns like we saw with Obama, I don't expect that to happen Monday night. But debates are important in another sense. You know, let's leave aside the punditry of who's going to win or who's going to lose. Let's talk about the nation. Debates are important because that's an opportunity for candidates to explain to the American people what their positions are and what they're going to do if elected. In other words, to gain a mandate. It's one thing to be elected. It's another thing to govern. And what has been so striking, and I've made a lot of commentary about this election, is whoever wins, no one's going to have a mandate. Nobody knows what these candidates precisely stand for. And they're going to have a divided Congress, and they're not going to be able to come in the way Ronald Reagan did in 1980 and say, you know, I have a mandate to cut taxes, deregulate, and build up defense. I don't know what the mandate would be, no matter the outcome of this election. And that's been very dispiriting. It's why I go back to my friend George McGovern. You knew exactly what George McGovern would have done if he were elected.
Right. Well, you know, your point's well taken. They'll spend $6 billion on this election, and we'll be exactly back where we are with gridlock. If the Dems pick up a few Senate seats, they'll only hold the Senate, but they won't have a filibuster-proof threshold, and then the House will probably stay in Republican hands. So it'll be gridlock and gridlock and gridlock. But just in the last minute or two, Alan, the polls, and I know you've made a good case that they're a waste of time, and there certainly are all over the place. But the Romney's ahead in likely voters in that category, but registered voters put Obama ahead. So that suggests to me that the likely voters on the Republican side are fired up, and the likely voters on the Democratic side aren't fired up. So how?
Or there's another explanation.
Uh-huh.
The gap between the likely voters and the registered voters in the Gallup poll is 5 to 6 points. That's impossible. Mathematically, that can't work because there are only 10% voters screened out. That is, registered but unlikely voters are only 10%. The math doesn't work. So I think there's big problems in how they screen for likely and unlikely voters. But secondly, Republicans traditionally have been higher turnout folks. So when you're looking to, how do you know who's a likely voter? A lot of it is what people have done in the past, where Republicans generally have done better and their demographic tends to be a higher turnout demographic. But what the likely voters cannot take into account in any way, shape, or form is the ground game. Who has the better ground game? Who has the better organization? And who is going to turn out more voters? And that can cut in the opposite direction of the likely voter screen. And one indication of that is not polls, but early voting. And so far, where we have Democratic versus Republican ballots in Iowa and Ohio, Obama is way ahead in the early voting. So that kind of cuts against this whole likely voter model. And I also think every pollster has a different method for screening likely voters, which is why there's a 9-point difference between the high polls and the low polls for Obama and Romney.
So you think that the we know the African Americans will show up on the Democratic side. They are the most reliable constituency. There's some doubt about the Latinos who could show up in large numbers, and it'd be a sweep for Obama if they did. And you've got the basic American left that's kind of disappointed that their miracle worker turned out to be mortal, and they're not too thrilled. So. I'm not sure that the turnout is necessarily good on the Democratic side.
We won't know because we don't know how good the ground game is. I just gave you one indication, though, that right. This likely voter screen may not be all that it's cracked up to.
Well, thank you so much, Alan. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Ian. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Alan Lichtman, who's a distinguished professor of history at American University. He studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about what's really going on in Libya. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Abu Bakr Saad, who is a professor of history at Western Connecticut State University, where he researches issues related to the history of the Middle East and Arab unity. He's originally from Benghazi, Libya, and worked for the Libyan government prior to Muammar Gaddafi's coup. He stayed in a government employee, eventually working for several years as Gaddafi's translator. And in the 1970s, he and others plotted to overthrow Gaddafi. Professor Saad had to flee the country when the plot fell apart, and he is now a U.S. citizen. Welcome to Background Briefing, Abu Bakr Saad.
Thank you.
And your former hometown of Benghazi, Libya, is of course is both the focus of so much of this political campaign in terms of the foreign policy issues, and the Romney campaign is trying to stir the pot here. It seems to be their central issue in attacking Obama's foreign policy. And if it's inevitably going to come up in tomorrow night's final debate, which is about foreign policy, But I'd like to talk to you because you know Libya, you're in touch with what's going on there. And it seems to me that almost everything we're hearing in both the attacks on Obama's handling of the situation at the consulate in Benghazi and the defense that the White House has put out are so muddled that they completely miss the context. So give us some context here about what's really going on in Benghazi.
Well, Benghazi, as many of the Libyan cities and towns, it is not just Benghazi. The whole country, after the regime of Muammar Gaddafi collapsed, sort of fell in the hands of various militias, and you have all of these militias in towns and villages, and some of these militias are urban militias in the cities, and some of these militias are tribal militias that controlled by certain tribes, and you have the regional militias. So you really have a hodgepodge of all sorts of militias that the central government that's currently in Libya virtually has no control over them. They act on their own. Actually, the central government itself comes under attack from them almost on a weekly basis. It is, you know, we don't hear about those incidents because it doesn't involve us. But believe me, it is a very chaotic situation in Libya, and conflicts and clashes and fights are going on a weekly basis.
Well, there's apparently substantial battles going on in Bani Walid.
Exactly.
Which is the area loyal to...
Bani Walid is still actually holding up their views of Gaddafi. They're actually still flying Gaddafi's flag, and they are refusing to recognize the central government that has been taking over the country for almost a year now. They never recognized it. And they don't want to surrender those who had committed crimes during the regime. Many of the regime dignitaries of Gaddafi's regime are actually hiding in Bani Walid, and they are not giving them up. And the military, the regime's army, which is very weak, and some of the militias are actually besieging Bani Walid, and there's a sullies of rounds and fire going on between the two sides for more than a week now. So it is, and that's only just one example, because we have so many other areas. So basically, these militias are well armed, and they can react on a notice, you know, in a moment's notice. So really, they are not really under control of anybody.
So there have been reports, of course, that Gaddafi's son Hamis was captured in Bani Walid, and that's been mm-hmm. denied. Uh-huh. Also, his spokesman is supposed to have been captured, and then the spokesman issued a tape saying that he hasn't been captured.
Exactly. Well, the two examples that you have just mentioned gives you an indication of how chaotic it is.
Right.
You know, it's in itself that's a proof that really nobody knows exactly what's going on, and everybody is creating rumors against the other side and so forth. It is, you know, the country is really restless. It is, I mean, I hate to use this word, but it is lawless in a sense.
So we don't know what's happening with Hamis, whether he's alive or not. That's Gaddafi's son, and
we don't
know what happened with Musa Ibrahim.
And actually,
right?
Even in Libya, they actually don't know. Right. Everybody is actually guessing, speculating, because of the chaotic situation. Because if they have control over the territories, they can tell you who's in and who's out. But right now, they don't. I mean, Libya's borders are virtually open. Anybody can walk in and walk out anytime. There's no control whatsoever of Libya's border. So those individuals or those groups, they can actually move in and out as they wish.
So, again, I'm speaking with Aboubakar Saad, a professor of history at Western Connecticut State University. He originally is from Benghazi, Libya, and worked for the Libyan government prior to Muammar Gaddafi's coup. He stayed a government employee, eventually working for several years as Gaddafi's translator. And in the 1970s, he and others plotted to overthrow Gaddafi. Professor Saad had to flee the country when the plot fell apart, and he's now a U.S. citizen. So back to Benghazi again, which has become a political football in this presidential campaign, but nothing that either side is saying about it really does present the picture of why things happened the way they did. So walk us through your understanding of what happened on that night, which, of course, happened to be on the anniversary of 9/11.
Exactly. It is basically coincided with the anniversary of 9/11 and also coincided with the Egyptian demonstrations against the film that, or the, you know, that video that has been published at that particular time. The two events happen exactly on the same day. There's some speculation that actually what happened is there's some group of people that are not so large, probably in the tens or if less than 100, who are basically trying to protest in a similar protest as the one that took place in Cairo earlier that morning. What happened is because there are several militias in Benghazi, and some of those militias are really anti-U.S. and anti the West. What they did, they took advantage of the situation, and all of a sudden, those less than 100 people dispersed immediately, and that particular group carried out their attack. It's a spontaneous attack, but of course, it is attack that has been building up because of the fact that they don't like the U.S. They are extremist Islamist groups who are among those militias, and they have their own militias. It doesn't mean that really has been planned for months and so forth and all of these kind of analysis that we've been hearing all around. No, it was a spontaneous, but it was carried by a specific group. And that specific group did all of the damage. And I am not surprised because the clashes are going on a weekly basis and all around the country.
And it seems that pretty much we know who that group was. And
yeah.
The leader of the group has been quite defiant. He's been interviewed on Al Jazeera.
Exactly. Ansar, it's called Ansar Sharia. And Ansar Sharia is a group that actually have multi-branches. It has a branch in Benghazi. It has a branch in Tripoli. It has a branch in Tunisia, in Tunis. Tunisia. It has a branch in Algeria. It has, you know, it is really, they are what we lump them together throughout the Muslim world as the Salafis, which really an extreme conservative interpretation of the religion of Islam.
And the Salafis, of course, in Egypt were financed by Saudi,
exactly.
By Saudi Arabia.
They just carry different names.
Right, but they all
have the same ideas. They all belong to that umbrella that we call the Salafis. But in reality, all of them are basically at different with different titles, with different locations. But they all have the same extra conservative interpretation of the religion.
I was going to say they've been financed largely by Saudi Arabia, the Salafist party that came in second in the Egyptian.
Not only Saudi Arabia, there are so many conservative Muslims, wealthy conservative Muslims all around the Muslim world who actually provide for these people.
So what's your understanding then of what can be done? You know, President Obama in his second debate when he was challenged on this issue about and Romney was trying to make some hay out of it. I think the president essentially made Romney look like a fool because he had his facts wrong. But that's not going to stop them from keep hammering away at this, and it'll happen again tomorrow, I'm sure.
Yeah.
The president has vowed to bring those people to justice. So if the leader of Ansar al-Islam there in what's the name again? Ansar what?
Ansar Sharia.
Oh,
Ansar al-Sharia
in Benghazi is defiant and appearing on television and laughing at the Americans. Is there any way that Obama can be good to his word and bring those responsible to justice?
I'm sure he can be good to his word, but the problem is there's no proof whatsoever that they have. It is all rhetoric that's going on. Even that leader of the group is actually using rhetoric, and he's challenging the West, and he's challenging the United States. But, you know, when you are going after a criminal, you need evidence. And that's basically what should be done right now. And actually, that's going on at this moment. There is a team of our FBI that's already in Libya that is investigating exactly who is responsible and how it happened and all of the details of it. Until that is done, all what you're going to hear is political rhetoric from all sides.
But what once they make that decision, and assuming it is Ansar al-Sharir and this leader, how will they arrest him?
Well, then they have to go after him. But the problem is we don't really have the solid evidence that who did what and who carried what, because everybody's pointing the finger at everybody else. We all have to be patient with the investigation that's going on right now. Until that investigation is completed, all you're going to hear is political rhetoric from all sides, because they really don't have the facts.
I understand that.
Anybody can say, I'm going to bring him to justice and I'm not going to bring him to justice. I'm going to attack him and all of that kind of stuff. You're going to hear it from all parties.
Right.
But in reality, nobody can do anything until we finally have a report from the investigation team saying who's exactly responsible for that. And then we can go after that.
Right, but that's my question. Given the lawlessness of the country, the layers of different militias, and the inability of the central government to have control over the country, let alone over Benghazi, who is going to do the actual arrest?
Well, it has to be some sort of a cooperation, because you have to remember this is a country right now is in a chaotic situation that they had started rebuilding their army from scratch. They are rebuilding their police force from scratch, and they are not making a good headway in either one of them. So here, they really don't even have the means to arrest these people. Look at what's going on in Beni Waleed. They have people, and they know that these people are in Beni Waleed, and they can't reach him. So here, what happens is once we find who is really responsible, we can help that particular authority in order to arrest that. And I mean, they can't do it on their own. We have to give them a help in order to actually arrest those responsible.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Abu Bakr Saad.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Abu Bakr Saad, who's professor of history at Western Connecticut State University, where he researches issues related to the history of the Middle East and Arab unity. He's originally from Benghazi, Libya, and he worked for the Libyan government prior to Muammar Gaddafi's coup. He stayed a government employee, eventually working for several years as Gaddafi's translator. And in the 1970s, he and others plotted to overthrow Gaddafi. Professor Saad fled the country when the plot fell apart, and he's now a U.S. citizen. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.